The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 17. The Comfort of a Storm. Hogwarts had never been the warmest of places, and they were now in winter, as hard as it was to believe. It was cold. Cold enough that unless you were actively engaged in melting the bones of another person with pleasure and blowing them out of their mind, going to bed required extra layers of clothes. It was a pity, because Severus liked very much the image of a certain werewolf wearing nothing but a pair of discardable boxers to his bed. A pajama-clad werewolf was also acceptable as long as he still went to his bed, his. And that was a thought that brought warmth and a feeling like a hug, just as being invited to Remus's bed had always done something to Severus's insides. It all boiled down to being wanted. What a wonderful and addicting feeling it is to know that you are wanted and, in this case, loved. Severus should get up and get something to wear, too. He could already feel the tip of his nose going cold, but he was unable to, on account of being currently boneless and extremely well shagged.
"Severus," called Remus from the dresser.
"Yes."
"Why do you have a dozen unopened packages of tights?"
Severus craned his neck to see Remus had four of said packages in his hands. One pair was in a box with a blue ribbon still on top of the lid and the others in envelopes. Severus let his head fall back in the pillow as he considered his answer.
"Would it be all right if they were open?"
he said at last in a calm tone, calm and smooth like butter, because currently Severus was all soft and had no joints.
"Well, yes,"
Remus said in that tone of his when he thought something was very obvious and he could not understand why someone would try to complicate it. The "we don't have to have sex if you are tired" tone, the "I understand you were busy, funnily enough I keep up with the news, don't fret about it" tone. The first few times Severus had heard it, it had been almost painful. Such understanding invited a vulnerability that Severus knew could also bring a lot of hurt. But such is the nature of love, to leave yourself open to the possibility of pain. However, this was not the case. Remus was asking his boyfriend, about the clearly feminine tights in Severus's possession, and apparently it did not merit even a shadow of surprise or appallment.
"That would make sense,"
Remus waved with the hand holding the closed and sealed envelopes.
"But why keep buying more if you are not using them?"
Severus was probably the only person ever to ask that question, the only one.
"Misdirection."
Remus looked down at the tights.
"Oh, I see. Very clever."
That said, he put the tights back in the drawer and closed it, opening the one below and getting the sleeping shirt and soft trousers he had been looking for. Severus found he could not take his eyes away from him, enthralled by the line of his back and the angle of his hip as he closed the drawer.
"So if you had discovered that I had them for my personal use," he prompted.
"I would be surprised, because I have never seen any signs of this preference,"
Remus said as he put on the shirt. The worst thing, and the very best thing, was that Remus was being perfectly honest. Remus, this Severus knew well, had never gotten much experience in sexual matters, something that Remus was always happy to remedy. There had never been a time in Remus's life when he got so used to having a lover by his side that he felt he could experiment and introduce new things in the bedroom. Yet Remus was, well, Severus didn't know if he was extremely lucky or utterly kinkless, but in any case, he didn't seem surprised by anything, and he accepted everything. The most adventurous virgin, so to speak. How Severus loved him. He was blessed by having him in his life.
"It's a pity that no one is using them,"
Remus went on, coming back to bed.
"Don't you have anyone you could give them to?"
"No," Severus said quickly as he was hit in the chest with some clothes, because of course Remus had brought him some. "And I am perfectly aware that you are being facetious right now." Remus snorted and smiled the wolf smile, the one that made bellies everywhere tingle.
"You could give them to Lovegood,"
he insisted nevertheless, probably because he enjoyed seeing Severus frowning. Maybe that was his kink after all, seeing how his eyes sparkled with amusement. Think about what you just said. True, she seems to favor striped socks. He made a pause, letting the thought of Lovegood vanish. Not that Severus trusted him. Remus, like the hunter, liked to let you think you were safe so you would take your guard down.
I'm not serious. Do you mind if I give them to him?
Remus laughed long and hard at Severus's disturbed yet controlled expression. In case anyone ever wondered why and how those two became friends, it was for things like this. Not for his use. He'll give them to McGonagall. Severus hesitated. As much as I enjoy my rivalry with Minerva, sometimes I feel bad for her. Minerva had put a swift end to the competition for most mischievous student ever by naming Potter, Harry, and Weasley, Ron, the ultimate and unsurpassable winners.
I mean it? Don't even think about trying to take their place. Unsurpassable, I said.
She stood by her judgment because Harry was giving her headaches even in absentia, and although Ronald grumbled a little bit that he didn't do nothing, there was not much force behind it. Minerva didn't know exactly what Ron had done or not done, but she would glare at him as if she knew, and the boy looked guilty enough. At this point, she wouldn't even be that surprised if he turned out to be an animagus, too. He had kept quiet about Severus's involvement with Harry, and he cast Protegos non-verbally, so who knew what else he could do? She should look into it, she should. But she had no chance to think much about Ron Weasley, who was being very helpful this year and not giving her any trouble to begin with. No chance, because those idiots were apparently dissatisfied with the quick end to their competition, and they had created a new one to fill the vacuum.
A woman as high and noble as you couldn't possibly be loved as she deserves by just one man, for how could a single chest store so much emotion?
Said Fred, or maybe George, as Minerva walked past, ignoring them on her way into her second class of the day. Just a second, take note. And already she had to deal with this.
Truly, 'tis only us that could do justice to such a high lady, added the other twin,
one hand over his heart and the other extended dramatically after her. She had had warning. Trelawney tried to tell her, and she didn't listen, and now Sirius and the twins had, for reasons that escaped everyone, moved into the equally glorious and honorable race for Minerva's favor. This, at least, was something she was more used to, even if she hadn't had to turn suitors away in decades. It was annoying, but less dangerous for the rest of the castle, so she bore it with patience. Besides, unlike with a prank war, they couldn't throw in all their energy. In mischief, Filch was their default enemy, and Filch wasn't good for anything, so they could get away with a lot. In this, however, they risked awaking the ire of Pansy Parkinson, who took harassment very seriously, so they had to check themselves.
Avast, you villains!
Sirius turned the corner like the best Shakespearean actor would enter a stage.
My lady's name is that of Wisdom, and she shall not suffer your foolish speech. Indeed, only those whose minds camber high, like the ether in the tower spire, those whose very name is written in the stars, shall know the glory of winning her favor.
That said, Sirius proceeded to mock fight the twins, hitting them repeatedly with a glove.
That is enough, Black. Cut it.
Ah, your cruel words hurt me like a spear thrust upon my chest. Yet to know that this scorn is directed at me is a gift that I shall prize. For your contempt, as it comes from your lips, becomes the sweetest balm for my ears, knowing that for a second you held my image in your mind.
Three Ravenclaw girls started to clap. Sirius beamed at them before quickly directing his attention back to McGonagall and speaking about exchanging tokens of love. Minerva looked at Remus, who was just coming from teaching his class. She looked at him, not pleadingly, precisely. She did not look pleadingly at all, more like demanding that he put his friends in check. Responsible and mature friend, do your job.
Do not look at me,
Remus said in his very male and very adult voice, not the voice of someone joking. He smiled just a little bit, like the edge of a knife.
I don't know that I could resist the force of your eyes.
Dear Merlin.
I'm a wolf, Minerva, and those cow eyes of yours.
Why? Avery Jr. was dead. His father was very angry, so were Voldemort and Bella. Narcissa wasn't. She was not happy about it. What a horrible thought, no, but she wasn't exactly upset either. There was this feeling of disconnection from all of it, and the most she could get was he brought it on himself, which she was sure was not an emotion. But really, the girl was a black. Not in name, certainly, not before the law, since she was the female spawn of a disinherited female, but she was a black in blood, like Sirius, like Bella. What did they expect? What had Avery expected? Of course, Narcissa didn't say any of that. She didn't say anything. She put on a black and green coat over her usual white dress when they went to attend the funeral. A concession to Gaspar Avery, who was mad with grief. She kept the white, though, because it was hers, and she wasn't discarding it for a stupid boy. It might have been an insult, and it might have been dangerous, an act that spoke of too much dissidence, but she was not the only one. Bella was dressed in turquoise. Turquoise! And the Dark Lord had smiled at her when he saw her in that dress and kept her hanging from his arm for the rest of the day. It had been the girl's fault for fighting back and daring to hurt and kill a proper pureblood wizard. There was no doubt about that, and they already called for her death. But that didn't erase Eric's fault, going against the Dark Lord's explicit words and being stupid about it. He would be buried as was proper, but no one should pay him too many respects. His father, however, was already calling for revenge and saying he would go get the girl himself. Yaxley had volunteered to help him because Yaxley had also been punished for his participation in the girl's escape. It wasn't very visible, but there had been some form of amputation for having left his broomstick in the open waiting to be snatched. Well, Bella's curse wasn't visible, although everybody was talking about it. The Dark Lord had thought that while that was a good penalty, the rest of his Death Eaters could do with a more permanent reminder of what their failures could bring them. Voldemort was quite sure that there was no other Dark Wizard rising to power in Europe. There simply was no way people could keep such a secret away from him. Still, it didn't hurt to give everyone a reminder of their sworn allegiance to him, the importance of the cause, and his own power. Just in case they were paying too much attention to those rumors and getting ideas. Well, it hurt Yaxley, but he hardly needed the left side of his face. Lucius wanted to talk with Snape, as he always did. He liked his wife to be silent, but he drank Snape's voice and words. However, he barely got to exchange a few words, because Snape was invited to stand by the Dark Lord's right hand. Bella didn't even pout when she heard, opting for pressing her chest against their lord's arm instead, and drinking in the pleased smile he sent her way. There was something about Bella, Narcissa knew, a sudden apprehension. No one would know it was there, but Narcissa had known her since they were children. She recognized the same unease line in her mouth from when Bella went out and lost her virginity before marriage and tried to keep it a secret from their parents. It was very rare for Bella to feel like she had done something wrong and experience guilt. Not that the Dark Lord seemed to have noticed. Narcissa had no way to know, but she guessed that Bella's thoughts were loud and hot like the roar of a fire, and a small pebble of guilt would hardly draw any attention. She doubted that the Dark Lord wanted to spend much time in Bella's mind. Her company and her body was another thing, but not her mind. Narcissa looked at Snape, who was giving Bellatrix his usual look of quiet judgment and bemusement, as if he couldn't believe that such a creature could exist. Of course, he was not one to judge, no matter how proper he might look now, all dressed in black. He had once been as desperately in love as Bella was. He envied her. Narcissa knew he had envied and hated her. The delightful irony was that she envied him too. She envied the power he still had over Lucius. She envied the obvious preference Lucius always had for him. And she envied his love. Because Narcissa had never loved someone like that. She hadn't loved her husband like he did. She loved her son, but that was a different kind of love. It was a love like a mountain, a love of ice and stone. A love that was hard and durable and unnoticed. Nothing at all like the sweet, hot passion shared between lovers. She looked at him now because it was better than looking at her sister preening and dressed in turquoise, and looking at either of them was much easier than looking at the Dark Lord. Snape was not a handsome man. He was not ugly. But his nose was too big, his skin too pale for the dark shade of his hair and eyes. His figure in general was narrow and pointy, and nothing like Lucius or the young Mulciber or any of Narcissa's cousins. Yet he was sought and favored both by Lucius, who was an objectively attractive man, and by the Dark Lord himself. He was nothing like the beauty hanging from the Dark Lord's left arm, yet he was offered his right hand. She must have been thinking too loudly. The Dark Lord looked straight at her, his red eyes flashing like embers. Narcissa allowed a wave of sorrow to surge forward. Oh, why wasn't she like either of them? What did she lack that she couldn't please her lord or her husband? Voldemort looked away, bored already. It was too common a thought. If he had noticed it, it was because there had been an unusual complexity in Narcissa's thoughts. Accidental, most likely. The result of a small housewife who kept poking at the same thoughts hour after hour. That's why she had managed anything of depth. There resided the answer she sought, too. She was proper and obedient and boring, and she had nothing of the allure of Voldemort's two favorites. Remus understood that Severus didn't like showing much affection in public, and it didn't bother him. Severus had spent 16 years undercover lying about something or another, and he was currently the headmaster of the school and had to keep a certain dignified air. Of course he avoided showing in public any kind of emotion whatsoever other than a quiet, judgmental air. The problem wasn't that, not that it was a problem at all. The difficulty, so to speak, was that Severus was so very committed to propriety that he refused to be dragged behind a curtain so he could be thoroughly smooched after saying something funny or doing something kind. No, really, the way he treated Lovegood, the respect he gave her, the demands. People saw her as odd and dreamy and crossed her out unconsciously. But Severus had her taking notes and running errands and treated her like an adult, and somehow the girl responded. She was still dreamy and still odd, but if she didn't end up heading an apartment in the ministry or managing her own business chain, Remus would be very surprised. But to the point, he would like to kiss Severus right now, and apparently the space behind curtains, armors, little visited corridors, and empty classrooms were not acceptable, even though they were out of sight. Neither were offices, unless the door was double-locked. Perhaps he was right about the corridors, because Hogwarts had seen a significant increase in population, and ever since the opening of the houses, everybody kept moving freely. The number itself probably wasn't that much higher than usual, refugees making up for the Muggleborns who couldn't return, but there was certainly quite a lot of traffic. All the adults wanted to make themselves useful, and there was this feeling of anticipation and wanting to be ready. Still, smooching, Remus needed to smooch Severus urgently. After the week, as they were referring to it, the chaos generated had been so big that Voldemort could not spare an hour to come check Hogwarts himself, nor was he in the mood to send anyone in his place. But a few days later, Severus had been summoned to give a detailed report of the indoctrination in Hogwarts. It was mostly to assuage Voldemort's fears, and because it pleased him to hear that someone was actually performing his job well. Today's meeting had gone well. Severus would tell him more later, but it had probably gone well. After all, Voldemort wanted to believe the lies Severus told him. That in itself was cause enough for Remus wanting to snog. Just because Severus made it almost ordinary, it wasn't any less amazing how well he could lie to the Dark Lord's face. Voldemort suspected nothing, and the combination of Severus's complaints about the Kara's impulsiveness and lack of class, together with the fabricated reports of Electo Kara whining about Severus stifling her artistic expression, worked wonderfully. However, as it had also become sort of habitual, Severus had returned with a few refugees. A man and two women looking ragged and bone-tired, although if Remus looked closer it seemed that it was just one woman, a bright-eyed woman, and a boy and a girl. Old enough to fight, old enough to be chased and arrested and hurt. But to Remus, still children, probably around Harry's age and far too young to be touched by war. The boy in particular seemed to have taken the worst of it. His face was bruised and stained with blood, and he was keeping his left arm very close to his body. He was only wearing a t-shirt and striped pajama bottoms, one of the legs rolled up. He was so tired, so profoundly exhausted, that he couldn't even bring himself to roll it down his calf. He was also barefoot, and if he was standing at all, it was because the girl next to him had a supporting arm around his back.
"Lovegood," called Severus as soon as he crossed the doors, followed by the woman who was looking at everything with an assessing eye.
"Yes, Professor. Madame Pomfrey for medical attention, and either Professor Sprout or Professor McGonagall for housing."
Luna Lovegood was wearing two different kinds of knee-high striped socks and a green sweater with yellow puffs that were supposed to represent dandelions made by her friend Millicent. She looked quite goofy. In fact, she looked stupid. But somehow Severus could see past the garish eyesore and notice the amazing brain behind. Luna only needed to be told something once, and she remembered accurately and without mixing any details. Just as Remus had the twins helping him, Severus had Luna. Only in their case it was quite different, and not just because of the clash of clothing styles.
"I will also tell Professor Flitwick," Luna went on. However, instead of running up the stairs, she went towards the new arrivals, coming to a stop next to the girl.
The poor girl had the lost gaze of those who had gone through a shock, and she didn't even register Luna's presence. Her face, her beautiful baby doll face, was marred by the spidery black lines of a curse. Remus had a couple of ideas of what could have caused that mark, and it was not the kind of hex you could simply walk off. Someone had been looking after that girl, protected her after she was hit, saved her life.
Good.
She was wearing blue cotton tights, torn on the knees that looked way too thin for the current weather. Luna smiled gently and kissed her on the cheek, the right cheek with the black mark.
"It is very good to see you, Joe," she said, hugging her briefly.
That seemed to jostle the girl out of her shock. She blinked and her eyes filled with tears as she turned to look at Luna.
"Come this way," Severus told them, ushering them towards the great hall where they would be fed.
That was usually the first thing they did when they brought people back.
"And Lovegood," he added over his shoulder, "bring the match for this one, will you?"
"Of course, sir, right away."
That was the thing with Severus and Luna. They didn't speak English. Whatever they were doing, it was not English. It was cryptic, is what it was. Severus said something utterly devoid of meaning and context, and somehow Luna always understood what she was supposed to do. She ran up the stairs, her long sunflower blonde mane trailing behind, and they moved to the great hall. They sat together, tired and silent. The woman with very bright eyes was directing the others to sit, to drink, to eat. Remus noticed she didn't take anything for herself, too busy taking care of her group and looking around the room, scanning the hall for any threats. She didn't have a wand, but she had barely been at the table for 2 seconds before one of the knives found its way into her pocket. The young man took a cup full of water with both hands. His face was caked with dirt and dust and blood. The girl, Cho, stared at the piece of bread in front of her as if she had never seen one before and had no idea how to eat it. The woman quickly took the bread from her hands and put a bowl of soup instead. The great hall was mostly empty at that time, but these days mostly empty still meant having half a dozen people around at the very least. The group tasked with improving the Protego-imbued cloaks liked to work there between meals since apparently the light was best. For an hour, Severus and Minerva had feared that having the refugees there would become a problem. Too many empty hours during the day and too much trauma were a bad combination. For an hour, it seemed like there was nothing for them to do at the school and that they would simply hang around in the background, safe but tortured by their experience, just for an hour. Then Philip or Julius, Remus couldn't remember, had shaken himself and tentatively asked if he could make a suggestion for a DADA class. They had all been out there. They had all seen what worked and what didn't. There was no Quidditch this year, but they were giving extra flight lessons because nowadays, as Amanda had pointed out, broomstick flight was the only travel method that was not controlled. Remus was being very insistent with the Expecto Patronum, and naturally many students, and even adults, were having trouble with it.
So again, they had extra classes in the evenings. Even the squibs were helping, carefully and methodically brewing potions or helping expand the greenhouses, because there was this terror spread between all of them of needing a healing potion and coming up empty. Remus understood. It was the first and second years, and even the thirds and fourths. You looked at them, all those vulnerable children, and of course you came up with the compulsion to put on them a thick sweater and a cloak that would stop curses. It was probably why Remus made Luna recite the recipe for a powerful antidote, forwards and backwards. Just then, Luna returned with Madame Pomfrey and a Gryffindor boy who, as soon as he stepped into the great hall, let a wail not unlike the one of a banshee. It was one of the worst sounds anyone had heard. As if in that cry the boy were letting out all the pain and fear and sadness he had been storing inside his chest for months. He ran to the table, still screaming. And he didn't so much hug the other boy, who had already gotten up in shaking legs, as he collided into him, both crashing to the floor and crying and crying.
"You're an idiot,"
Seamus managed to say between sobs.
"Going away like that? You're an idiot. But you're my idiot, and you can't disappear ever again, I forbid it."
"All right," the other boy, Dean, said very faintly from somewhere between Seamus's arms and chest.
"No, I mean it. You can't go. Not going anywhere."
A promise of something else. Severus had done that. Even if he was now talking to Madame Pomfrey as if nothing out of the ordinary were going on not 10 steps away from him, Severus, who pretended not to care, he had known, and hadn't wanted to delay that moment of happiness. Tomorrow Remus was going to test Finnegan again, and he was sure he would produce an excellent Patronus. But as for right now, Remus just needed to take Severus's stupid face between his hands and kiss him senseless.
"Are you free right now?"
"I am headmaster of this school."
"I know, but..."
"And you are teaching arguably the most important subject in their lives, and your class starts in 20 minutes.
"I could be done in 15.
"No.
"Fred can start without me. We can do a practical exercise today."
"Remus, no."
"Fine, I'll see you before dinner, then."
Severus argued some more, but after the last official lesson was done, he went to look for Remus himself, and they kissed in his office for 20 minutes before they both had to go attend to something else. While Harry escaping from Voldemort's clutches twice was good, excellent even, and the misdirection created in Hogwarts was also good, the chaos generated was not. True, the fire in the Mudblood Registry was a good thing, names and names that became safer as they burned, but the Ministry couldn't let these series of calamities go unanswered. They stopped pretending. They did not make up excuses anymore to arrest people, to lock them up, to kill them. They simply did. Some said that they had started attacking Muggles, and the only reason why they were not going to open war against them yet was because they were too busy fighting against the Irish government. It wasn't until they had consumed the first dish at dinner that Dean and Cho seemed to start waking up. In Cho's case, it meant that she started to cry. Overwhelmed by the familiar vision of students sitting down to dinner, Luna sat by her side, caressing her hair and giving her water from time to time so she wouldn't dehydrate, and let her cry. It was very important to let people cry. They had arranged a transport to the continent, Cho said. They had been planning it for weeks with the help of some wizards and witches that used to be Aurors and called themselves the Order of the Phoenix. They had already successfully gotten a ship out back in September. Only this time, someone had spoken too much and word got out. They had been attacked while they waited in an abandoned farmhouse. Dean hadn't hesitated, jumping down and getting in front of Cho when she was hit. Aurora had followed suit, and together they had gotten Cho up, and they had kept the Death Eaters at bay long enough for everyone else to be able to leave once the portkey was activated. They had left without them, which was the sensible thing to do and what they had all agreed beforehand. They had left, and Aurora, Dean, and Cho stayed and fought for their lives. Cho had cast Glacio on herself, which cancelled the worst effects of the curse long enough that she could join the fight and provide Dean with much-needed support. They had run. Aurora cast a bombarder that took 2 snatchers down and gave them enough of a cover that they could get away.
Still, they knew they couldn't get very far away, not when there were 3 confirmed Death Eaters, marks on their arms and silver masks with them, and 8 more Ministry wizards plus a couple werewolves chasing them. They had come expecting to capture 20 people. The blood of the 3 of them would be barely enough to satisfy them. And that's when the miracle happened. There was the pop of an apparition, very soft and muted, which meant it was excellently executed, and standing before them was a figure dressed in silver. Relicho didn't need to say anything else for everyone to know who it was, and wasn't that unbelievable? It was so rare for someone to actually get to see him. "Kneel," Galahad had said, with a voice as soft as English rain, and Cho had dropped to her knees immediately. He had raised his left arm, and that in itself was a queer and uncanny vision, wielding the wand with the left hand, and something black and sticky like a piece of nightmare erupted from it and engulfed the 3 closest snatchers. He had extended his hand then, the right one, the hand of light, and they all grabbed it tightly, and before they knew it, they had disappeared and reappeared in an abandoned church in the middle of nowhere, where Severus Snape found them not 20 minutes later. There was some oohs and ahs and some questions about how Galahad looked, because none of them had actually gotten to see his face, which was generally accepted to be strikingly handsome, although perhaps scarred in all the right ways. However, all they could say was that his cloak and his boots were misty gray. Cho was sure that he was very tall and lean, and she didn't want to say right away in public, but the implication was that she also thought him extremely hot. More details to come later when they weren't in the Great Hall.
"Wow, I can't believe you were rescued by Galahad himself. No one ever gets to see him in person."
There was a small pause as everyone chewed on their food and reflected on the wonderful mystery that was Galahad.
"That must have been the greatest rescue ever," said Colin Creevy with his still high-pitched voice.
At least he didn't sound like he could break glass anymore.
"I can't imagine a bigger surprise."
"Actually..." Dean hadn't spoken much because he was hungry and it was very difficult to eat when you had 3 Gryffindor boys insisting on hugging you at the same time. Seriously, he had Ron's chin resting over the top of his head while Seamus and Neville hugged his waist and chest.
"This summer, I kid you not, I have witnesses. This summer I was almost murdered and I was saved by Draco and Harry. And that was the weirdest experience of my whole life. Hermione came later."
They had to allow Seamus to come with Dean while they interviewed him. Dean spoke with Seamus's arms around his waist and his head in his lap, and when he told them how close he had been to dying, Seamus closed his eyes tight with pain and held Dean closer. Creature had failed to tell them about Draco and Hermione doing magic without wands, and there certainly had been no mention whatsoever about human-to-tree transformation. Remus and Severus exchanged the international parental look of disavowal. The one that started with, "Your son, daughter," followed by whatever action had been done and some elucubration as to who had taught the kid to do that. It goes, "Look at what your son did. He didn't get it from me."
"Yaxley was the only one to return from that encounter," Severus explained. "And his account was quite different."
Yaxley's version had way more wizards in it. Remus Lupin breaking people's necks and Alistair Moody making the earth shake. There had been no one else to refute it, so they had had to accept that Yaxley was the only one to survive an ambush set by the Old Order. That was it, until the last Hallows' Eve, when Alicia and Montgomery had wandered into a Muggle town. Alicia and Montgomery, who were supposed to be dead. True, they didn't seem very alive at the moment, but their presence cast a doubt over Yaxley's version. Unfortunately, they could not give their own version of events, because neither of them had managed to say a word since they were found. For the most part, they just stood in place in a sunny spot. As soon as the gargoyle slid back in place, Remus took Severus's arm and pulled him into a kiss that was going to be shallow and brief, but that soon increased in intensity and had them standing there like fools for minutes. They did not kiss as they were going up the stairs because they were both grown-ups with responsibilities and there was no reason to risk a fall, but as soon as they were on the landing, Remus kissed Severus again. He put his hand on Severus's nape, making sure that his arm offered enough back support that he could march Severus backwards across the office without fear of tripping and without interrupting the kiss. Remus's free hand was making a rude gesture. Dear Merlin, who would have thought that of Lupin? For the most part, the portraits of former headmasters and headmistresses remained asleep, and the one that didn't and insisted on sharing his opinion would know to keep quiet. They kissed all the way to the bedroom.
Once there, Remus went down on his knees swiftly and got Severus in his mouth. There was always quite a rush of emotion when you have a werewolf's head, a werewolf's mouth right there between your legs. There is always that involuntary fear that can become very exciting. And then there is a time when the fear is gone, replaced by trust and affection. And that is even more arousing. It is the wild beast that you know won't hurt you because you are that special. It is the wild beast tamed by your scent. Or in this case, not beast, but Remus, wonderful, glorious Remus, who insisted on loving Severus despite all the good reasons why he shouldn't. Severus had stopped voicing those reasons aloud because the last time he did, he had made Remus angry, truly angry, and he had felt a sharp pain in his chest from seeing him like that. That had been back when they had Harry and a cottage, and they lived in a time and a world of their own. He had almost brought back all of those old reasons, plus the new ones he had found during the terrible interval without Remus. But Remus had made it clear he wouldn't hear a word of it. And then he had been kissing him, so Severus spoke of something else. These days, even in the middle of a war and with their child hiding and in danger, Severus still didn't mention the reason why Remus shouldn't be with him, not even to himself. That was the surprising part. At some point he had stopped listening to his own thoughts and instead brought Remus's voice to his mind. Remus. Can we? Remus leaned back, letting him slip out of his mouth. He rested his head against Severus's leg and smiled, and truly it was the most beautiful thing Severus had ever seen. His smile and his hair and his brown and green eyes that held the light and the spirit of the forest. Whatever you want, he said. It was that easy, that open. Then I want this to last, Severus said, because today had been a pretty good day. Remus got up and took his hand, pulling him along to bed, and silly, silly Severus. Always so careful with his words and what he had said and what he thought. And 10 minutes with him, and he lowered all his defenses, and he stopped thinking. He said whatever he wanted with no second thought for the consequences. Remus made it last indeed. By the end of it, probably the end of it, when he came for the third time, Severus was exhausted and sweaty, so sweaty. He had a cramp in his hand from grabbing the sheets too tight, sheets that were now wet and too hot, just like him. His hair was matted and wet, and his belly and his legs were covered in lube and cum, and he felt so dirty and gross. Remus lay by his side, still breathing fast. Not only did werewolves have more strength, it had become evident that they also had more stamina, because Remus was winded, but he was far from being utterly exhausted like Severus was, and he had been doing quite a lot of the work. Remus took Severus's face in both hands and kissed him, long and shallow, a good sweet kiss. Severus was still tired and covered in sweat, his and Remus's, and saliva, both again, and cum, yeah, both. But with that kiss he felt for a moment, as if he were one of the most precious and delicate creatures in the world. Something gentle and expensive and worthy. They did little else that night. Just the most basic clean-up before falling asleep, still entwined in each other. In the morning they woke up reasonably early. Since Severus was going to take a long and thorough shower, Remus said they might as well. And this is how Severus found himself laying on his back in a nest of ruined sheets, and with a very handsome man riding him. Outside there was a winter storm coming. The thunder of the wind must have woken them. Severus moved his hands up the length of Remus's thighs to his hips, and he looked into his eyes and thought that he was a very lucky man, such treasure he held in his hands. Remus looked down at him and smiled, and Severus knew he understood, but just in case he told him so. Words of warmth and velvet whispered in his ear. Severus thought that Remus could always do with another declaration of affection.
He had thought for too long that no one would ever dare love a werewolf, and it was now Severus's happy responsibility to remind him that it was quite the opposite. And since he was up there, smelling his hair and whispering in his ear, he could tell him about his eyes and his smile, and about how warm and tight and big and soft and hard he was. How beautiful. It started to rain heavily. Thunder and rain that made a drowning noise against the windows. A noise that almost drowned their sighs and their gasps and the rustle of the sheets. They finished and cleaned up, and Severus had breakfast delivered to them because it was one of those mornings. They still had time before classes began. They could go down to the Great Hall for breakfast, but they could also spend that time in here together. Severus had never thought of it much, but he liked watching Remus drink hot drinks. He liked seeing him in warm sweaters and eating hot meals, and he just really, really liked seeing him not be cold. He looked so cold and sick when he came back to Hogwarts to hunt Pettigrew. But this was something he had felt before that, some desire to see him taken care of. Something must have shown in his face, or maybe it was the storm that was making it feel like night, even though it was okay. And night and darkness worked better for them. Remus looked at him, a steaming mug held between his hands. "Do you think you would want to get married?" he said. "I think I would like to marry you." That soppy, sentimental, idiot man. Severus's heart did something in his chest. His heart had never done such acrobatics as it did with Remus. Before Remus, it had certainly beaten fast with passion and lust and something like love. And it had been crushed and broken. With Remus, however, it leaped and jumped and danced. "We already live together and have raised a child. Marriage doesn't seem like much of a compromise. Sure, most people do it in a different order, but nevertheless, would you like to?" Severus thought about it. This was a very new line of thought. He had never thought about marriage for himself. The one and only time he did, he had been informed that he would never be more than a mistress. Never to occupy the legitimate position of a pure-blooded woman who could provide an heir in social standing and quite a nice dowry. Severus was to be on the sidelines of a marriage, never in one. He leaned forward and captured one of Remus's hands while he thought about it. Lest Remus feel rejected, that would be terrible now. "No," he said at last. "I don't think so."
"No?"
Remus sounded surprised, and his hands jumped a little bit, but he didn't pull it away from Severus's grasp. He knew by now that Severus looked at everything differently.
"There would be a ceremony," Severus informed.
He was quite sure he was onto something here.
"People would be invited. I don't have any friends. It would look sad and uneven." "Of course you have friends."
Remus was already gearing up to defend Severus's honor from himself.
"And?"
Severus pressed on Remus's hand slightly to indicate that was his big argument.
"You would, of course, want Black to be your best man."
"Well, yes, I could not think of anyone else. He's my best friend, you know that, and he would want to be there. He's been very supportive." It's not as if Remus had noticed the effort both Sirius and Severus had been making to learn to like each other.
"He would make a speech, Remus. He would make a speech. I am not subjecting myself to Black's best man speech."
The only reason why Sirius's speech at James and Lily's wedding wasn't remembered as a historical moment of cringe was because James's had been even worse.
"I see your point, but if we eloped, he would never forgive me. He would still appear in the chapel in time. I know he would."
Remus smiled.
"You know, he probably would."
He rose from his seat and gave Severus a quick and light kiss on the lips.
"I'm still marrying you. You have my permission to look as sour and bitter as you want during his speech."
"Oh?" The storm went on. Dark skies and a loud thunder that made for a wonderfully dramatic background.
"Back off, Black! Do not sully our lady with your presence!"
called George from the other side of the corridor. There was a big window behind him, and he cut a nice figure against it. He had been taking tips from someone, most likely Sirius himself.
"Villains! What is the meaning of this?"
said Sirius automatically, while Minerva desperately tried to hide any signs of relief. Black had looked like he was about to give her one of those pairs of expensive tights Severus had warned her about. The interruption was most welcomed.
"The Ministry himself has spoken, and the word is spread across the land!"
yelled Fred, waving a piece of parchment and coming from behind a suit of armor. Never let it be said that the twins didn't take an opportunity to increase the drama.
"You are called undesirable, Sirius Black,"
said George, like one would say Stormcrow, herald of woe.
"Undesirable in this kingdom, second only to one."
"Really?"
Sirius asked, breaking character and looking quite excited about the news. Indeed, apparently Aurora, the woman who had come yesterday with Dean and Cho, had kept in her pocket a ministry-issued poster with a list of the 10 worst undesirables.
"Number 2, Black,"
said Minerva, relishing the opportunity to use her mocking, disappointed tone.
"I think this settles it. If he can't be number 1, then I won't even consider it."
The lady has spoken!
Cried Fred and George in unison. They immediately started a weird interpretive dance of celebration in which they used their wands to shoot sparkles.
"Although I see that Mr. Weasley and Mr. Weasley are also featured, sharing a space, too. Could not even merit their own number."
True, the twins had won ex equo the position number 10. Just right after Moody and Kingsley Shacklebolt, they were quite pleased with it, despite the relatively low classification. Just getting into the top 10 was an honor. If anything, the fact that Moody was number 9 was the real head-scratcher here.
"Oh, dear,"
said Ron, who was coming from Charm's class, because of course Minerva always had to deal with this nonsense early in the morning.
"I don't think I could keep trying to romance anyone after this. It's really embarrassing."
Ronald was an excellent student assistant. "The knight that would come out of nowhere to take your bishop."
"Shut up, Ronnie. You're not even on the list."
"Because I'm discreet, and they don't know what I get up to. But if they did, I would certainly not be 4 positions behind Cedric Diggory."
"How could he be 6th?
Fred whispered despondently.
"He always seemed so nice. What did he do?"
For once, the meeting had been brief. Creature said that Harry and the others believed that Voldemort had hidden a Horcrux in Hogwarts. Dumbledore said that Tom had always been obsessed with the school and dreamed of becoming a professor first and eventually headmaster, so it was not impossible that he had chosen to leave a piece of his soul there. He was glad that despite everything, Harry was still following the plan.
"I will cut the stones to which your painting is attached, and I will chuck the whole thing in the lake."
Flitwick did not look like he could hold the headmaster's portrait, let alone the wall from which it hung, but he spoke as if he had already researched the spell he would need, and behind him, Minerva looked like she would claw the painting out with her own 2 hands. Dumbledore did not apologize, but he abandoned Gracchus Deerhart's portrait and went back to his own. It was agreed that they should at least consider the possibility of there being a Horcrux in Hogwarts and start a search. The twins plus Sirius and Remus would revisit some of the old hiding spaces, and if they didn't find anything right away, they would share the information with the school, emphasizing the importance of not touching the Horcrux if found. Then there would be the matter of destroying it, but they were all pretty confident they could do it. Dumbledore kept trying to explain how he conjured the fiend fire, underlying how unstable and dangerous it was. Flitwick had come close to demonstrating right there and then with Dumbledore's portrait, because months ago Albus had asked him to cast some protective spells on an old dry fountain in one of the cloisters, and now they knew why. After a lot of coughing and humming and saying he was just being a good friend and no one should get angry, Weasley, Ronald, had confessed that maybe there was a live basilisk still in the castle, which also came to explain the mysterious recent discovery of a silver rat paw. So there was always the possibility of chucking the Horcrux down the pipes and to the basilisk's mouth if they came to it. In the end, they needn't disturb the basilisk. It went like this. Neville, like much of the school, was racking his brains, thinking where the Horcrux that Creature mentioned could be. He thought about that all the time. He thought about it when he slept, when he bathed, when he ate, and certainly when he walked back to the dormitories. He was thinking about it now, as he took a slightly longer route to class, because he didn't want to come across Ernie McMillan. Would Neville hit Ernie? No. It lost its flavor soon enough. But he didn't want to talk to him or listen to him, so the longer route it was. A door appeared when there hadn't been any doors. The child that Neville used to be, the child that would have never opened a door that wasn't there seconds ago. That child had been scared and hurting quite a lot. But Neville wasn't that child anymore, and not for a long time now. He had grown more than many adults can aspire to grow. Sometime during his fifth year, his body and his mind had said enough, and Neville stopped caring and stopped being afraid. He had grown 10 centimeters, as if the fear had been holding him down in more ways than one. At the end of his sixth year, with Dumbledore's death recent, he went by himself to Diagon Alley, blessed night bus that took you anywhere if you couldn't operate yet, and he had bought himself a wand at Ollivander's, a wand of his own, not his father's. Neville had lived enough in the shadows cast by his ill parents. They didn't want that kind of life for him. And that was not wishful thinking, he knew. His mother told him again and again. She told him she wanted him to be happy. Neville got his own wand, and grandmother had been angry. Not as angry as she had been after the riots, he thought, but somehow this fight was much worse. Neville looked at her with brown eyes, plain brown that never got a beautiful metaphor in books beyond chocolate. Maybe Neville's eyes were like warm, sweet chocolate, or maybe they were like the earth or dirt that stored life, or like the strong oak that had lived for centuries. They were his eyes, in any case, and they were firm and sure when he told her that he was grateful that she took care of him as a child. And of course he was, but you did a really poor job, Augusta. She had fed him, and she had dressed him, and she had also resented and punished him for not being the Auror his father had been. She did that since he was age 1. Neville didn't yell back, and he didn't blow up things in his rage. He packed his things and left the house, and the most satisfying thing he did was that he didn't close the door behind him. He left it open, a physical testament to his lack of cares. And Augusta Longbottom was forced to go and close it, which enraged her more than any slam of the door would. He spent those crazy summer months at Zabini's. His first choice had been the Burrow, but it had already been burned down. Zabini's was fine, though. There were many other students living there, and Mrs. Zabini was quite welcoming. She was not like Mrs. Weasley at all, though. She would not feed you any delicious and comforting foods, and she didn't knit. Apparently the arm motion wasn't aesthetically pleasing, but she would laugh and declare that you were not yummy, but you were going to be, and she taught you how to win at cards with barely any cheating. Not really, no one should ever play cards with the children that spent the summer at her house. It was a wonder that Death Eaters hadn't come to recruit her, but then again, she didn't look completely human. Not like she had goblin or troll or vela blood, more like she was a goddess in disguise, and who wants to risk enraging that? The point in any case was that Neville opened the door and stepped inside the room of requirements. He took a look, rows upon rows of objects piling to the ceiling. Nope. He stepped back and closed the door. His next class was charms, and he didn't want to miss it, but Flitwick would understand. Neville stepped away from the door until he saw it disappear, and then he stepped closer, and when he opened the door this time, it took him to the library, probably because Neville was now looking for answers. 20 minutes Neville stood there, walking backwards and forwards until he got the first room back, and he figured that the damned Horcrux must be hiding there, but where? And there was a distinctive feeling of, for Merlin's sake, kid, coming from the room the next time he opened the door. And there was a window that hadn't previously been there, and the sun rays filtering through it fell over an old marble bust, with a beautiful diamond and sapphire tiara on it. "Professor Snape, I broke something." "I don't care," Snape answered lightning quick. Then he paused for just a second and tensed in preparation for bad news. "Was it something of mine?" "No, sir." "Then I really don't care." "I think it may have been an historical heirloom," Neville went on. "Did it have something to do with the unearthly sound that went through the castle, filling with fear and despair all the unfortunate souls that heard it?" "Black," Snape warned.
"I heard that too,"
Luna said excitedly, because it wasn't every day that you heard an unearthly sound that went through the entire castle, filling its unfortunate occupants with fear and despair. Professor Snape had made her a tisane to take away the fright.
"It may be, yes," Neville admitted.
The screech had been pretty loud. There was a time when Neville had been terrified of Professor Snape, but now there was only respect and, yes, a bit of fear, but of a different quality. And ever since Snape started explaining a bit more about the ingredients used in potions, Neville had actually improved, and he went from utter disaster to disappointingly below average. Considering where he had started, it was a meteoric ascension.
I'll look into it, shall I? You do that, Black.
They met in the teacher's common room. There were no headmaster portraits there.
He says he smashed it with a hammer, said Sirius, pointing at the little pieces of what had been a tiara collected in a handkerchief.
They were mostly sand, which gave it the impression that Neville hadn't just hit the tiara once, but had been going at it for a while and with much enthusiasm.
Then it may not be...
Probably a special hammer. Goblin made or something. He'll hear the shriek.
It had certainly been very much like the sound of a piece of cursed soul departing the object from which it was attached. Not that anyone other than creature had experience with that kind of sound, but somehow one could tell. The merfolk were still gathered around the underwater window in the Slytherin common room, asking with signs what was going on. The funny second-year Hufflepuff was attempting to explain through pantomime. Sirius had also brought the hammer for inspection. Only it had shattered together with the tiara, and all they had was a small and blackened piece of the handle with a few blurred runes on it. Professor Babbling kept looking at them and shaking her head. There was no conclusive identification.
And I found a scarf I had lost in my second year, Sirius went on, showing said scarf. And look at this! This is the spider web we made in our fourth year. It can block a medium-sized corridor and hold up to 5 Slytherins and a small Hufflepuff at a time. We tried it, actually, never mind, silly thing. I'm sure Remus told us not to. Please, Severus, stop frowning at me like that. Oh, you know what? Mooney here helped with the design, so there's no need to blame just me. Frown at him too, will you?
I'm sure I was sick at the time, Remus said pleasantly when Severus, Minerva, and Slughorn all turned to look at him. For a week, students and teacher had had to take a different route to potions class while Filch tried to remove the spider web.
End of chapter 17. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.